Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The U.S. Supreme Court has been extraordinarily busy overturning precedent. Last year, in an historic move, they struck down race-conscious admissions at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and at Harvard University, upending more than 40 years of legal precedent and effectively ending the ability for both public and private colleges to consider race as a factor in admitting qualified students. In his opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the court's decision, he wrote that the court's decision sees universities' admissions policies for what they are, rudderless, race-based preferences, policies that fly in the face of our colorblind constitution. In her dissent, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson characterized the majority's defense as a case of let-them-eat-cake obliviousness, adding, "Today, the majority pulls the ripcord and announces colorblindness for all by legal fiat, but deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life." Those are her words. And many feared the decision would result in fewer minority students gaining access to elite schools. This fall's enrollment figures are the first test of that. At many of those schools, black admissions dropped significantly, but not at all schools. For instance, while black admissions were down at UNC Chapel Hill, they were slightly up at Duke University. So this hour we explore the early indicators of the impact of this Supreme Court decision and how it may dictate the future of higher education. Brian Cook joins us. He is Director of Higher Education Policy at the Urban Institute. Chris Marsicano is Associate Professor of Educational Studies and Political Policy and Director of the College Crisis Initiative at Davidson College. And Corey Dean is Higher Education Reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Good morning to you all. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. You got to talk. It's radio. Brian, I'm going to start with you. We're going to get into some specifics and some details of all this as we go through the program. But first, let's get the 30,000-foot view here. Overall, have the misgivings that some had over the Supreme Court's decision to end race-based admissions borne the bitter fruit that some people have predicted?
Well, Mike, I don't know if this quite falls in the category of a pun, but the jury is still out on that. We're starting to see some of the early numbers that come in. And as you pointed out, they're a bit of a mixed bag, with some schools experiencing declines and others actually seeing increases in certain populations. And I think, as compelling as the enrollment numbers are, and as long as people have been awaiting these numbers, they're only one piece of the admissions puzzle. And so without additional contextual data, it's really hard to make sense of what we're seeing and exactly how it relates to last summer's Supreme Court ruling.
So for people who have not been following this all that carefully, for the purposes of context here, NPR reports that programs promoting race-conscious admissions had been supported for years by narrow Supreme Court majorities that included Republican-nominated justices. But this decision ended, quote, "what most colleges say they need to do, consider race as one of many factors in deciding which of the qualified applicants is to be admitted." Brian, are there other criteria that schools used to make that determination that continue to be in place?
In terms of gaining admissions to these institutions?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are many criteria. I mean, the reality is that race was simply one of many factors that are being used by selective institutions. Not dissimilar from legacy and other factors that contribute. So yes, I mean, you know, there are many other factors that go into this decision. And race historically has been simply one, but it has been a key one in terms of ensuring diversity, because a lot of models, statistical models that have been used to replicate race neutral policies, have found that not being able to consider race, there are no race neutral policies that will get you the exact same result. And we've seen that play out in states that have banned affirmative action, like Michigan, in California, where those schools are still, they still have not returned to levels that they had seen in terms of diversity prior to the banning of affirmative action.
Chris, this decision by the Supreme Court was the result of a lawsuit that specifically targeted Harvard University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, but it has much broader implications than that. In fact, would I be wrong in saying that this decision affects every private and public university and college in the nation?
I think that's not entirely wrong, but not entirely right either. So when we're talking about higher education in the United States, we're really talking about 6,000 institutions, everything ranging from a local HVAC repair school up to Harvard. And for the vast majority of colleges and universities, the 1,500 or so public and nonprofit universities and colleges in the United States that have four-year degrees, affirmative action wasn't a major issue for these institutions. And in fact, when we're talking about affirmative action in the cases of Harvard and UNC, we're talking about very selective institutions. Students for Fair Admissions, the organization that brought the lawsuits against Harvard and UNC on behalf of a handful of Asian American students, targeted about 160 institutions. When the ruling came down, it sent a letter to those institutions saying, hey, we're watching you. Should also mention that while the Supreme Court case says that that race cannot be used in admissions, it does add a caveat that it can be used in the case where a student can articulate the way in which their race or their ethnicity has affected their character or their character development. I should also mention there's another caveat, which we're seeing very important today, is that military academies may continue to use affirmative action. And that there's a case against the U.S. Naval Academy brought by the same people who brought the Harvard case and who previously had brought the University of Texas at Austin case and are currently adjudicating that case today.
I was going to bring that up much later in the program, but as long as you brought it up, Chris, we'll talk about it. An attorney for the U.S. Naval Academy said on Monday that the academy should continue using race and ethnicity in admissions because it was not where it needed to be in building a diverse student body. Joshua Gardner told the U.S. District Court in Baltimore, quote, real progress is being made. We're just not there yet. They are apparently exempt from this Supreme Court ruling because the court said the military may have, quote, distinct interests in considering race and ethnic background. And as you mentioned, that same organization, Students for Fair Admissions, whose suit led to the decision in the Harvard UNC case, is also suing the Naval Academy. Why would the military get a carve out?
Mike, this is a question that higher education scholars and policy thinkers have been trying to answer ever since the case was decided. It's not clear why the military gets a carve out why the U.S. Naval Academy gets a carve out when, say, the Citadel or Virginia Military Institute does not. Institutions who have the same goals to create an officer corps for the U.S. military. Look, I understand why the Navy wants to maintain affirmative action. 65% of all naval Navy officers and enlisted men are white. 75% of the officers are white. Of the 56% of Marines are white, yet 81% of their officers are white. When our leaders don't look like the people they're leading, that is a difficult. The Navy argues that is a difficult thing for the battlefield, for cases in which people are deployed.
Brian, could it be argued that's an argument that could be used in the private sector as well? And it just seems to me if the military needs to be reflective of society at large are reflected in this carve-out for the Naval Academy, that perhaps, I'm not sure what the question is here, but perhaps that should be considered at large. What's the difference? Do you see a difference?
Oh, I don't see a difference. I mean, if diversity is a value in our military forces, why would it not be valued among medical professionals? Why would it not be valued among educators? Why would it not be valued among social work professionals? There's a range of professions in which the same type of diversity that's valued in our military forces should also be valued. I actually used to work an organization that represented dental education. And one of their primary concerns was how to diversify the oral healthcare field. And certainly the ruling last year does not help in that effort. And so I think a lot of individuals would argue that the same carve out that was implemented for the military academies could easily be applied to a number of areas within higher education.
Cora Dean's with us. She's a higher education reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. I'm sorry, Chris. I'll get to you in a second. But this ruling just came down on Monday, or this story just came down on Monday. Is anybody in our circles, in education circles in North Carolina, talking about this and what the implications of this may be going forward?
You're talking specifically about the military carve out.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that I'm not aware of any.
Okay.
You know, I cover pretty much the UNC system, some private colleges, so I don't know that it would apply as much here, but I could be just not aware of a college or university here that it would apply to. So I'm open to other input on that.
Okay, Chris, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You wanted to chime in.
Yeah, I'll just add that this is not a new position for the U.S. military in the history of affirmative action, in the history of affirmative action cases, Grutter, Gratz, Bakke, all of the sort of Supreme Court cases that have dealt with affirmative action. The U.S. military has consistently filed amicus briefs, amici, basically saying, look, diversity is a valuable reason. Diversity in and of itself is a valuable reason for affirmative action to take place, simply because we need our leaders to reflect the diversity of the country.
So in writing the majority opinion in that Maine Supreme Court ruling last year, Chief Justice John Roberts, a longtime critic of affirmative action, wrote, quote, many universities have for too long concluded wrongly that the touchstone of an individual's identity is not challenges bested, skills built, or lessons learned, but the color of their skin. Our constitutional history does not tolerate that choice. Now, I know that nobody on this panel is a constitutional scholar, but Chris, what about these race-conscious policies went against the Constitution? And how is it prohibited by the Constitution? Do you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, the argument is that it violates the 14th Amendment, the equal protection under the laws, that institutions that are receiving federal aid therefore must follow the Constitution such that they cannot provide preferences based purely on race. That's at least the argument. That argument was not compelling until this Supreme Court. That argument was brought up in the Fisher case, in which Abigail Fisher cases, say, both one and two, in which Abigail Fisher was denied admission through a special process at the University of Texas at Austin, and sued to try to end affirmative action. In those cases, it was unsuccessful then. Only after the Supreme Court's makeup has changed has that argument not fallen on deaf ears. I should mention that in all of these cases where plaintiffs have sued Harvard, have sued Texas, have sued Carolina, most of them have ended up at nearly equally selective schools. It is hard to argue that they have been terribly worse off because they didn't attend these institutions. In fact, one of the plaintiffs in the SSFA case versus Harvard is Kenny Zhu, a Davidson alum. So we get our back up a little bit when we think that somehow his life could have been better at Harvard than at Davidson. We're very proud. We have some pride in the Davidson College education.
This seems to fall along political lines, Corey. We have a Supreme Court that is predominantly people appointed by Republican presidents, and they've been overturning precedents in other aspects of American life quite a lot in the last couple of years, precedents that have been established for a long time. Is this more than politics, Corey? And I have 20 seconds.
Oh, gosh, that's a big question. I mean, I think it's hard not to see the politics there, but as we've talked about, these cases wound through the courts for a long time. So I think that there was a longstanding want among some people to get rid of this precedent. So, I think the legacy of the court will be written much later.
We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Supreme Court's decision that affirmative action policies in higher education admissions were not legal, essentially not constitutional. And we are now just a little less than a year into that, but that decision is reflected in admissions numbers coming in from around the country. We're going to talk about that with Brian Cook, Director of Higher Education Policy with the Urban Institute. Chris Marsicano is Associate Professor of Educational Studies and Public Policy at Davidson College, and Corey Dean is a higher education reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. We heard Chief Justice John Roberts' majority opinion saying that this use of race as a factor in college admissions does not fit, went against the Constitution. On the other hand, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissenting opinion, argued that this decision, quote, the court subverts the constitutional guarantee of equal protection by further entrenching racial inequality in education. I'm going to ask you the question I just kind of posed to Corey, Brian, and that is, this just emblematic of the political divide in the country, that we simply see things from polar opposites?
I mean, I'd certainly hate to ascribe politics to it, but the reality is that, you know, when you think about inequality in this country, it typically does tend to fall along racial and economic lines. And when we think about something like access to post-secondary education, a lot of the issues actually begin in the K-12 system. And when you look at the K-12 system, you see significant inequities for households of color and low-income households. And so when you talk about, you know, inequities that start as early as preschool from an educational perspective, these individuals are having to make up a lot of ground to be able to qualify for admissions into these highly selective institutions, where the benefit of being able to consider race was an asset for these institutions to be able to weigh the fact that a lot of individuals are coming from, you know, educational backgrounds in which they did not have access to the same resources that some better off individuals did. And so no longer having that tool creates, you know, a challenge for ensuring equitable access. And so is that solely a function of politics? I mean, we're certainly a very partisan world today, but this fight has been going on even before we got to the point of partisanship that we are now. So I think politics is part of it, but it's not the complete picture.
Corey, take us back to, since the target of this was both Harvard and UNC Chapel Hill, from UNC Chapel Hill's point of view, take us back to the beginnings of this lawsuit. Why was it brought? What was going on with Asian students at UNC Chapel Hill, allegedly, that caused them to sue the university and take it all the way to the Supreme Court? And what has been the reaction of that school and others, institutes of higher learning in North Carolina, to the decision itself?
Yeah. So these two cases started about 10 years ago now, about 9 years ago when the decision came down. But Students for Fair Admissions, which is against affirmative action at UNC specifically, they said that UNC's race conscious admissions policy disproportionately discriminated against Asian American and white students, that they believed that Black students were getting in or other underrepresented minority students were getting in. But that Asian American and white students were, you know, discriminated against or disproportionately affected by that process. UNC on its part, you know, throughout the 10 years that it defended it, said that race is just one of many factors, that no student gets into the university because of their race, but it is a consideration that they may use. Obviously that is no longer, you know, I would say that clearly, colleges say they will follow the law. That's kind of been the top line that we've seen since the decision. But there have been some reactions, or, you know, programs put in place. UNC, for instance, said that it would offer free tuition to North Carolina residents who make whose families make $80,000 or less. That was, you know, they announced that in the context of this decision as possibly a way to continue to bring underrepresented students to campus. I'll also say that this is all happening this year in the context of the UNC system repealing its DEI requirements, which, you know, is just a separate but very related issue that, you know, affects how these universities in North Carolina can bring students to their campuses.
Let me ask you about that, because one of the things that the UNC System Board of Governors did, as you just said, they took specific action. They repealed the DEI requirements at all campuses, and as a result, a lot of those offices have closed. Many of the people who work there have been let go as a result. Would this have happened had this decision not come down?
Obviously, I can't, you know, I don't know the answer to the hypothetical, but I would say there still probably would have been a good chance. I mean, I think nationally, DEI has just been this huge hot button topic when you think about Florida, Texas, and I think there was an appetite in North Carolina to do something similar.
But as I understand it, and you reported that the Board of Governors approved this new policy called Equity Within the University of North Carolina, which emphasizes non-discrimination and institutional neutrality, whatever that is, but did not explicitly call for DEI offices to be eliminated. And yet that's what's happened here. Why?
So the UNC system actually early last year, before the Supreme Court decision, they adopted institutional neutrality. That was actually done in the state legislature. And they also enacted a ban on compelled speech. So that was, you can't ask faculty or other employees for like diversity statements in hiring. So I think we had seen kind of the groundwork be laid for some of these repeals of DEI. Again, even in both of those cases, DEI was never mentioned, but I think there was that appetite.
So if they did not specifically say we are going to eliminate these DEI departments, who made the decision? On what basis? Why did they do it?
So campus leaders, campus chancellors, provosts, student affairs professionals were tasked with implementing this over a series of 4 or 5 months. And the UNC system office did give legal guidance. Again, that guidance, it specifically mentioned DEI offices, but it did not say you have to eliminate your DEI offices.
And the system eliminated most DEI-related
yes.
jobs, most of which happened to be at UNC Charlotte. Why did we have more of those jobs than the other UNC system campuses?
I think some of it comes down to the size of campuses. I mean, if you think about, you know, a school that has 30,000 students versus a school that has 5,000 students or even fewer, you know, you have more personnel, more staff dedicated to those efforts. I think that was a big part of it. I think there was also just kind of some differences among campuses and how much they had, you know, implemented these things. You know, if you think about an HBCU, they're probably not going to have as much because it's part of their framework, their groundwork. But more predominantly white institutions may have had more efforts. So
Brian, just sticking with the UNC, I'm sorry, did you want to get in there, Chris?
Yeah, just given that Corey has mentioned HBCUs, I should note that one of the effects that we have begun to see, at least in the wake of this SFFA case, is that we've seen rapidly increased enrollment and rapidly increased applications at both North Carolina's public HBCUs and the private HBCUs, yeah. Not just in North Carolina, but across the country. HBCUs have shown themselves to be a refuge for students seeking a welcoming environment, should they be students of color, especially African-American students.
So just sticking with the UNC system for a moment here, Brian, they report a savings of more than $17 million from implementing the repeal of the system's diversity, equity, and inclusion policy. And they suggested that money would now be redirected towards student success initiatives. I'm not sure how this saves $17 million. Maybe it's just personnel costs, but have other schools who have also done something similar reported similar savings?
I have not followed the sort of the budgetary aspects of making these cuts. And I certainly don't believe that was one of the driving motivations behind a lot of the anti-DEI efforts as budget saving measures. But the one thing that I would say is that to take any financial savings from these cuts and use them for student success measures is certainly positive. But one of the challenges is that for students of color, DEI offices were often one of the foundational pieces of student success. And so you've essentially taken away a core aspect of student success for those individuals, and now you're saying you're going to replace it. And the question will ultimately be with what?
And Corey, have they been specific about what these student success initiatives are?
I wouldn't say super specific, but we have some ideas. A big one is in improving the graduation rates, the four-year graduation rates, improving student retention, you know, just essentially helping students get to the finish line of completing their degree, graduating with, you know, if you graduate on time, that leaves you with less debt, theoretically. So,
So, Chris, this is the first period of new enrollment since this decision was handed down by the Supreme Court. Has there been a discernible drop-off in the number of African-American students at various colleges and universities around the country? If so, how many and what does it tell you?
So, Mike, it's been a mixed bag. There are certainly some institutions where there's been a dramatic decrease, but in the case of some of the most elite and selective institutions, Duke, Yale, Princeton, we've seen very little decrease, and in fact, a decrease in Asian American applicants. Enrollees. So it is still so soon that it's hard to figure out why this is the case. We have some sense that what colleges and universities are doing is changing their recruitment strategies. I had an admission counselor friend of mine mention that his new job is to go to every Second Baptist church in the South and make sure to recruit there. And so there is no prohibition in the SFFA case that says you cannot increase your recruitment of African-American individuals, just that you cannot select students based on race unless that race has made a demonstrable impact on their character. And so by increasing recruitment in being aggressive in recruitment, as many colleges have been, you might not see as big of a drop off. Most colleges now are blinding the race. Students may still submit the race, but they are redacted in the admissions in the admissions sort of decision process. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that there aren't other potential cues. It doesn't mean that there aren't other ways to recruit students of color to these institutions. Well, I should also mention the $17 million that has gone away from DEI represents just 50 cents of every $100 that the UNC system spends.
When you say redacted, mm-hmm. are you saying that there's a box on an application form that asks you to list your race, and if you put it down, they'll redact that for the admissions people?
It just depends on the institution. Sometimes the institutions are no longer asking. So, for instance, Wake Forest no longer asks that information, and other times it's asked for information afterwards to provide reporting responsibilities to the federal government at the end. But it is redacted, meaning blacked out. You cannot see it during the actual decision making process.
The reason I ask is because you pointed out, and I was going to talk about this later in the program too, the fact that. In these college essays, for instance, that students write in their applications or in the interview process, they are allowed to bring up how race has impacted their character or their lives in some way. So even if you black that out, that you can, if you're clever, that's in the application somewhere, correct?
Yeah, and I should mention that, yes, if you're clever, you can mention it and find a way to talk about how it affected your character. But it is not specifically in sort of a concurring opinion. Okay. I believe it was Kavanaugh, so that I could be correct. I should be corrected on that if that is not the case. There was a statement that basically says that doesn't mean colleges can just make essay questions that allow you to do this. Some colleges did. I believe it was Skidmore who actually quoted the admissions decision and said, how does that affect your, how has your race or your character affected your character? It's still sort of unclear how every college is doing this. There's wide variety. And again, I should mention, only around 150 to 200 schools are even part of this discussion. The vast majority of higher education institutions are open access. If you have a high school degree or a GED, you are likely to be able to go into schools. So this is a very select few small number of institutions we're talking about.
Brian.
And Mike, just to add on what Chris said, I think the other important piece to think about regarding the student essay is that if you're thinking, particularly among the institutions that Chris has highlighted, which are really the focus of the affirmative action decision, they typically enroll traditional age students right out of high school. And so what you're essentially doing now is you're asking 17, 18-year-old individuals to now have to think about the way in which race has been a factor in their life just to gain admission into college. Like, that is putting a significant amount of burden on the student to sort of prove that their race has actually been something worth considering as an admissions criteria into the
institution.
Well,
it makes the young person think, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, it's never a bad thing to make a student think, but to have to show and prove why their race and ethnicity has been a complex factor in their life to gain admission to a post-secondary institution, I would argue, is not necessarily the direction we want to be going.
So, Brian, CNN reported last week, UNC Chapel Hill released a profile of incoming freshmen and transfer students that shows in the year since the gutting of affirmative action, the number of Black students admitted dropped from 10.5% to 7.8%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it represents a decrease of 25%. Harvard experienced a similar drop, and one UNC student told the network he chose UNC Chapel Hill because he saw a robust amount of diversity. So with this decline, he's now thinking about his choice to be there. Could thinking like that be a contributing factor to the decline in enrollment there and elsewhere? In other words, students see this and they think, well, I'm not welcome, so I'm not going to apply. I'm not going to go.
Oh, certainly. I mean, between the Supreme Court ruling, between state and institutional level anti-DEI initiatives, if you think about not just the culture for potentially incoming students, but the culture for returning students, like students who are already enrolled and on campus, it does seem to suggest a very unwelcoming environment. And so if you're an institution that is trying to actually increase your racial and ethnic diversity, these measures don't ultimately help. One other thing that I will point out that's important to consider in this is that among some of the schools that we've been working with on this project to actually collect a lot more data so we can understand the context of what we're seeing, is that we're finding that one of the categories where we're seeing some increases among students is race unknown. And so we're seeing a lot of students who seem to be now not disclosing their race, recognizing there really is no more value to it. And so to what extent is that contributing to some of the numbers that we're seeing is a lingering question.
So this is not affecting every student, every university in the same way. So in some places, enrollment of minorities has risen. Among those schools, Duke University, and among other minorities, enrollment is down. It's not just African-American students that we're talking about being affected by this affirmative action decision on the part of the Supreme Court this year. When we come back, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about race considerations still being on the table and impacts of this long-term on the real world, well beyond the time these young people get out of college. We'll come back with more of that in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on listener-funded WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact on higher education of the affirmative action decision that was handed down earlier by the United States Supreme Court. Brian Cook is here. He is Director of Higher Education Policy with the Urban Institute. Chris Marsicano is Associate Professor of Educational Studies and Public Policy at Davidson College. And Corey Dean is a higher education reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Corey, new figures from Chapel Hill also show a decline in Hispanic enrollment with this incoming class. Last year, Hispanic students represented 10.8% of the incoming class. This year, that number declined about 7%, or maybe it's about 7%. I'm not sure if I typed that out correctly. Are we seeing similar declines at Harvard and other colleges and universities that are obviously impacted by this decision?
I believe so. I think at Harvard, actually, the proportion of Hispanic students may have gone up. And I think that goes, I think Chris made the point earlier, that it really is a mixed bag. Even at Duke, down the road from UNC, they're seeing, you know, slightly different results. They had actually pretty similar racial makeup to what they had in the previous application admission cycle before the affirmative action decision came down. So, you know, I think, again, this goes to the point that there is just 1 year of data. There's some conflicting factors with the issues with FAFSA. But it, you know, in some ways, experts did predict that even without the FAFSA issues, that these declines would happen. So it's, you know, a lot to wade through. It's still a little murky, but a mixed bag so far, I think.
But at Duke University, Chris, they did, I believe this is accurate, they did not see a decline in Black enrollment in terms of this incoming class, but they did see a decline in Asian or Asian American student enrollment, which is kind of ironic because that's where this suit came from that created all this. The university says it has an unwavering commitment to diversity in all forms. Do you understand those numbers? What's going on at Duke and why?
I don't fully understand how those numbers got to be that way, but I do know that Duke has a long history of aggressive recruitment of students all across the country. And when you have a national recruiting body, that means that you're likely to get a much more diverse pool, right? Just by simply having a bigger pool on which to draw from in terms of applicants. Asian and Asian Americans at Duke have been a major portion of the Duke student body for decades. The numbers went down, I think, from something like 35% to 28% of the student body, far outpacing the percentage of Asian Americans in the general population. So Duke is still in a situation where it has an extraordinarily diverse racially class.
Moreover, Duke reports in an incoming first-year class characterized by an increase in socioeconomic diversity and a racial profile consistent with previous years. They report that of the 1,700-plus students in the class of 2028, 22% are Pell Grant eligible, double the amount of the class of 2026, and the university's percentage of financial aid recipients increased from 50% in 2026 to 56% for the class of 2027. Now, these are obviously concerted efforts on the part of the university to increase socioeconomic diversity. But Brian, can they offset whatever racial imbalances may be created by this Supreme Court decision?
Solely through focusing on economics?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's certainly an option, but given the fact that even though students of color and individuals of color are disproportionately low income, the overwhelming majority of low income individuals are still white. So the reality is if you're solely using economic measures without any other sort of factors such as zip code or something else, it could still be a challenge to diversify your population.
Chris Marsicano.
I would just add that Duke has among the most generous financial aid in the country. It has provided and extended its financial aid specifically to North and South Carolina residents as part of its mission, such that would be a big draw. But like Brian said, just having a strong financial aid program, just having a strong attempt at making costs low or loan reduction or student loans reduced on college campuses does not necessarily beget an increase in racial diversity. And in fact, my own research with Brent Evans at Vanderbilt University and Chris Bennett at the U.S. Department of Education suggests that when public institutions in particular adopt these generous financial aid programs, while they do decrease the amount of loans taken out and the number of loans, students with loans, they also decrease racial diversity on campuses. And that's because when you lower the cost of attendance, many more people will apply, regardless of their racial background.
Does that explain this, Corey? Because as Black enrollment declined within the UNC system, it was up at Duke University. They admitted slightly more Black students there. And Princeton and Yale, the number of Black students remain the same. Is it because they're out actively recruiting or giving out scholarships or financial aid, or is it because of some other factor?
I think the recruitment is a huge piece of it. And I would also note specifically at Duke, like Chris mentioned, they have increased their outreach to North and South Carolina students, specifically by offering free tuition to families who make $150,000 or less. I mentioned earlier that UNC did a similar thing for North Carolina residents, but the cutoff is $80,000. Yeah. So that's a huge difference that clearly, you know, probably encourages more people to apply. They think that the education is more within their reach. And, you know, I think UNC has also tried to other measures to improve recruitment, but I think that's an overriding factor at Duke, probably.
Of course, the stipend is larger at Duke because it costs more to go to Duke.
Yes.
Brian, go ahead.
The other thing I would add that I think has been an undercurrent in a lot of what we've talked about as it pertains to recruiting efforts is that one of the key pieces of missing data are the demographics of the applicant pool. I mean, if we simply had the demographics of the applicant pool, we'd have much more context for understanding the enrollment numbers. Schools who are seeing some declines in certain populations, if those same declines appeared in their applicant pool, it would make a little more sense, as opposed to if, in fact, those schools saw increases in those populations in their applicant pool and still experienced a decline, that tells a different story. So again, it goes back to the enrollment numbers being compelling, but they're just one piece of the puzzle.
So Chris, the Supreme Court didn't rule out using race as a consideration, particularly because if an applicant talks about it in their interview or they put it in their essay about how race has affected their character or their life in some way, that can be considered as a point of admission. It's just that the schools cannot have a policy mandating that race be considered. But would this put the universities, the colleges, in a particularly awkward position if they have to defend those decisions?
Certainly, but again, we're talking about some of the wealthiest, most selective institutions in the country. It's not hard to find a Duke alum or a Yale alum or a Princeton alum who will stand and be the attorney for those institutions. These are institutions that spend millions of dollars lobbying. I mean, these are institutions that I'm sure are up for a fight if that fight ever comes.
NYU law professor Melissa Murray, who's on television a lot these days, was the acting dean of University of California at Berkeley in 2016 and 17. That's when a state referendum in that state barred the use of race for college admissions decisions. And she noted an immediate drop in the number of Black students that she says was both a confluence of the change in the admissions policy, but also African-American students not wanting to go to Berkeley under those conditions. Brian, if you think that's true, can you explain that attitude? After all, it wasn't the school making the decision. It was the state of California. And in this case, it is the Supreme Court, not the school, making that decision.
Well, I don't know that students often make the distinction of the source of the change as opposed to the change in and of itself. And I think one of the other factors to consider in this is that we talked earlier about, you know, this 160 schools that are most likely impacted by these rulings. But the other thing to think about is, as we saw in California, the students who chose not to go to the Berkeleys or the UCLAs to even apply there, who were actually academically qualified, chose to enroll in less selective institutions. So the reality is that a lot of less selective institutions who may not consider race as a factor could see an increase in the number of students of color who have higher academic profiles than what they're used to seeing. And one of the concerns is for schools like that have enrollment crunches, does that then push students who barely got into those institutions down to another tier? And I know you talked about, you know, later getting into sort of the long-term outcomes, but it's what we call this cascading effect, yeah, where you see, you know, academically qualified students going one tier below where they probably could have gained admittance, and this pushing of students down the higher education chain.
I do want to talk about the impact in the real world. We'll get to that in just a second, I promise. Chris, go ahead.
Just say that what Brian's talking about here is known in the academic literature as undermatching. Students who are qualified to go into a much more selective institution choosing not to go to that institution. That is considered generally among scholars to be a problem, right? If there are highly qualified students who can do exceptional work, them not having the opportunity to do that work is sort of the antithesis of the American dream, right? We talk about this as a talent problem. Right? We want to get the best talent in the best positions to succeed. And just as a society, whether it's through college admissions or other areas, we're really bad at identifying good talent. Affirmative action was a tool to do that, was a tool to find students who may not have had the same opportunities because of their backgrounds and ensure that they are able to access a school or an opportunity befitting of their talent. It's a shame that we can't do that in the same way anymore, but schools are trying to find a way to work around this.
And Brian, there may be another factor at play here, one that you wrote about in an article several years ago for the Urban Institute, saying that Black students find greater satisfaction attending historically Black colleges and universities. And one of the reasons for that, you say, is that despite greater efforts prior to the Supreme Court's recent ruling to diversify predominantly white colleges and universities, very few have experienced any substantive change in the racial composition of a predominantly white faculty, administration, or student body. So given this recent court decision, isn't that likely to get worse?
Yes, I think it likely is. And not just the Supreme Court ruling, but a lot of the anti-DEI legislation that prohibits use of race in hiring. And so it's not just that you could see a decline in the in students of color, but you could see a decline in faculty of color as well, which, getting back to this question around culture, does not give as much of a welcoming culture to students of color. You contrast that with historical Black colleges and universities, and you find, you know, most often a welcoming culture for students who see faculty who look like them, who take great interest in the success of those students. And the reality is HBCUs are often doing that with significantly less funding than their predominantly white peer institutions. And so, yeah, so when you contrast that, it would not be surprising, as I think Chris mentioned earlier, to see increases among particularly African-American students to HBCU, similar to what we saw in 2020 after the issues around George Floyd and the social justice movement.
So there's a fellow named Zachary Bleemer, an economics professor at Princeton, who studies the impact of affirmative action bans, and says that when these bans are put in place, quote, Black and Hispanic students flow into less, you referred to this a second ago, Brian, they flow into less selective universities and as a result become a little bit less likely to earn a college degree, earn a degree in a lucrative STEM field, or in a graduate degree. And if you follow them into the labor market after college, you see meaningful decline from the order of 5 or 6% of people that disappear because they end up going to a selective school instead. This appears to have really broad social implications down the road and contributes to the othering of America, it seems to me. Do other studies that you know of, Chris, back that up?
Back up that there's a lack of opportunity by not going to the elite institutions?
Yes,
absolutely. I mean, we have a recent study that showcases that just 8 institutions are able to, that students who graduate just from a handful of what we consider to be the quote unquote Ivy plus colleges, the Ivy universities plus Duke, Chicago, and Stanford, and sometimes depending on who you're talking to, Johns Hopkins, that those institutions, students are likely to earn wages well above what they would go to if they went to another institution. I should mention that those institutions also have a much larger percentage of the top 1% of the economic distribution of the country. And so it should not be a surprise that students attending schools with wealthy students would have an opportunity to themselves become wealthy because they are learning from those wealthy students, which is what this gets down to, is that there are learning benefits from who your peers are in colleges and universities. And going to a selective institution provides those opportunities.
And in fact, these elite schools like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and others, they act as gatekeepers to the best jobs and the best places in the country, correct?
Depends on what you mean by the best. Certainly, if you are interested in public service, Texas A&M, whose graduates go on to a massive amount of military, Peace Corps, and other public service, is a fantastic university. Any state flagship is going to be aligned with the economy of their state, especially schools with names like NC State are going to be aligned with the economies of their state. I think it just depends on what you want to do. If you want to be a finance professional in New York, Columbia may be the right place. But if you want to be a winemaker, you should be looking at Sonoma State University or Cal Irvine. These are the places whose economies, whose teaching and learning is aligned to their states. And I should also mention, as a Davidson College professor, we can't forget the liberal arts institutions who teach you how to think in creative and different ways and tackle any problem that may come your way.
Liberal arts is a dangerous thing, Chris. You should know that. And with that, I have to stop because we are out of time. Many more questions, but we'll have to follow up on this because we're just beginning to get data. And as you pointed out, Brian, it's very difficult to get some of this data because schools are keeping it very close to the vest for legal and other reasons. Brian Cook is Director of Higher Education Policy at the Urban Institute. Chris Marsicano is Associate Professor of Educational Studies and Public Policy at Davidson College. And Corey Dean is a higher education reporter with the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.